This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome to another edition of Sellers Points Podcast. I, of course, am your illustrious host, Russell Sellers, back again to talk to you guys about some of those wonderful things that we all love and cherish every single week. That's some comic books and a few other things this episode. And joining me, as always, the master of the dulcet, smooth tones, the Ginger Barry White himself, Mr. Kelly Poole. How you doing today, sir?
I'm good.
There it is. There's that smooth tone. Oh, I love it. You know you do, too. Everybody at home loves it, man. That's what they've been telling me.
Okay. All right. Well, that's great. I'm glad. It's weird. Every time I've heard myself on a recording, and I guess maybe everybody's like this, you hear yourself and you're like, that's what I sound like to everybody? That's what you hear when I talk, right? Yeah. I'm like, that's weird. Or at least it is to me. I mean,
Well, since it was pointed out to me how, like, smooth and, like, just creamy that voice is, all I can hear is Barry White now, so hey. You know what, but the people love it. They come up to me all the time and they say, you know what, that Kelly Poole, he's the star of the show now, we don't need you anymore. I'm like, well, okay, folks, we'll make Kelly the star.
No, I'm just here in a support capacity.
A star is born. but they love listening to you, Kelly, and we love having you here on the show,
because
like me, You're all up in these comics. We're doing this every week, and this week's show, we're going to be introducing the folks to a new segment that we're going to be making kind of a regular thing. It's the first half of what we call our top and bottom. This episode, we're going to be talking about TV show adaptations. In other words, we're going to be talking about comic book TV shows, and what we have done is we have determined what the top five all-time best comic book TV shows are. And these are only live action, not animation. We'll do that later.
Wasn't easy.
No, it was not. There was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that went into this.
Almost 2.5 hours of deliberation on just this.
And it was a long, hard-fought thing, folks, but we did it for you. We did it because we know you want to know what the all-time best live-action comic book adaptation TV shows are. And we'll get more into that in the second half. We'll talk about what our criteria was for selecting, rules and everything else. But what we're going to do right now is kind of what we always do at the beginning of the show, is we go top to bottom two. Hi, see what I did there? Mm. And what this segment is over the last 2 weeks, usually it's 2 weeks. This time it's three because, as most of our loyal listeners know, we record on the first and third weeks of the month. But we had a rare fifth week this month. But we decided instead of doing a show, we just kind of be lazy like we do. Take that week off and include those books as possibilities for our top two picks and our bottom two picks of the last now 3 weeks. And of course, each of us will be giving some honorable mentions in there as well. But for this week, we've got, again, our top two books and our bottom two. So, Kelly, I want to start with you. Tell me what your first top pick was.
It was Blue Beetle.
that Blue Beetle Rebirth special.
Yes, yes. I loved every minute of it. I think what made me happy was seeing Ted Kord be his typical self. Just seeing on the printed page, seeing him kind of being a mentor to Jaime, and it was just a good book. It made me feel good, and I was happy. I think this book gives me an idea of how the direction of the rest, how the book's going to go forward. And I look forward to it and seeing another one of my favorites, Dr. Fate, show up at the very end of the book was even, another one of those, ooh, goosebumps. So, and I do plan on wearing my Dr. Fate shirt to the Doctor Strange premiere just to show a little love and,
Just a troll.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
But I do, I do love Doctor Strange, but, anyway.
Yeah, we can't get away from our DC fandom.
No.
It's impossible. I like that book, too. I thought Blue Beetle Rebirth was really good. It was really good work from Keith Giffen and Scott Collins, I believe, is the artist on that.
Yep.
I liked how it tied directly into the Rebirth special. It was a prequel and then a sort of like follow-up to it.
Yeah.
Cool stuff. It was definitely one that got my attention this week, although it did not make my top picks. My first top pick is not going to be a surprise to anybody, I don't think. It would be Superman number 5. Wow. Just this was my top pick. The week that this book came out, I was like, there were a lot of good books that came out, but nothing even remotely got close to how excited I was by the end of this issue. I never knew that I always wanted to have Lois Lane wear the Hellbat suit and beat the ever-living hell out of the Eradicator. That was something that was just one of the most awesome things I have ever seen on the printed page. And Doug Monkey knocked it out of the park with his rendition of that. But the story that Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason are writing, this has got to be, if it keeps this quality, this will go down as one of the all-time great Superman arcs. They have built this like just deeply emotional arc for Superman and for John, and seeing like how John reacts to his dad maybe possibly disappearing forever in this issue. Of course he didn't, but for all he knew, that was it, and he had to step up and start being a hero, and he does it. Like, you can tell that up to now he's definitely been his mother's son. He reminds me very much of a young Lois, but just like at the end of issue, I think it was issue 3, when it looked like Crypto died and he picks up Crypto's cape to put it on himself, and you see his eyes just go completely red. I was like, that was a moment where I was like, nope, he's also his father's son. Mm-hmm. And he's about to unleash. He's been a revelation of a character, and Tomasi and Gleason have written him so incredibly well, just about as well as they wrote Damian Wayne during the Batman and Robin days. So yeah. This issue was exciting, just wall-to-wall action, and just all heart, too. That's what I love about it, is that in all the action, it doesn't lose its characters. It's beautiful.
I think I'm not reading that book, but just, the way you described it makes me even more anxious and kind of wanting to see Super Sons. I want to see that book. I definitely want to. That's definitely something I'm gonna put my money down on and read.
Oh, we got the story arc that's going to introduce that's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah,
they're going to start that in Superman, and Super Sons is going to spin out of that. No idea who's writing it yet, but I'm reasonably sure that George Jimenez is going to be the artist. And he did an issue of Superman recently. He's got another one coming up. And after seeing that issue, I'm totally on board with him doing Super Sons. I think that will be awesome. excited to find out who's writing it. But Kelly, what was your next top book?
My next top book is Brainiac 5's girlfriend. to throw a little Legion love in there. It was Supergirl.
Supergirl Rebirth.
Yeah. Another fun book that I really just kind of, it gave me, you know, they kind of, let me pause here for just a second. Are we good with spoilers? Is this something that we're, you know, we?
Oh, we're totally gonna, like, at this point, these books have been out for like a couple of weeks. So
okay.
We're, you are right. Always in spoiler territory when you're on this show.
Okay. I just wanted to kind of make sure. But the book to me seemed like at first I was kind of scared. I was like, oh God, are they going to make this book kind of like a shadow of the TV series, which is really popular. And there are kind of some elements that kind of feel, you know, that they've kind of added to it. But it wasn't in any way, it didn't take anything away from it. I really felt like we're starting out with a with kind of an open palette for Kara as a character, and this whole, you know, issue was a really good kind of excuse me, just a good reintroduction to her to an extent, and to kind of show the fans, hey, you know, we're back. And to me, I mean, no offense to some of the pre, I mean, her new 52 series was awesome. I loved it. But her previous series before that had a lot of bumpy, you know, it was pretty bumpy there in the first 10 issues for me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It was kind of rough.
It was kind of rough. There was more art than there really was book. I mean, there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, the art, and it looked great, but there just wasn't a whole lot of substance there that would make it a great book. But this, I felt like just really, hey, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to come down the pipe in this book, just like I did with Blue Beetle. They kind of felt like they were parallel, the way that they were kind of, you know,
yeah,
the feeling I got from it, you know.
A little bit, actually, yeah. I could kind of see that being a thing. Like in the writing of both of those books, they emphasized the youth of both of those characters,
mm-hmm.
And you really felt like they were legitimately teenagers. They've got that mentality, but they're not the insufferable teenagers that had unfortunately cursed all of the New 52 for quite a while. These are teenagers that you're like, oh well, this is probably like closer to how, you know, a lot of teens actually are, like, not to the point of like, oh God, I want to strangle you.
Right.
Like, they're characters that are compelling. You want to read more of them. And I found Supergirl particularly charming, which
yeah,
I read
and
the,
where they have their, go ahead.
I read the preview of number one today, which is out this week, and should be out by the time anyone's listening to this. So, you know, go to your local comic shop and get that. I read that preview and I was like, this is still equally charming to the Rebirth special, so I'm really looking forward to reading this book.
Yeah, it felt a lot of ways like, you know, both characters, you know, Kara and Jaime, had their adult handlers to an extent. Their mentors or their, you know, that adult figure in their life, and that's what kind of drew me. I was like, this is kind of, you know, of course Ted and my mind's slipping as to who the female in charge of the, is it the DOA?
DEO.
DEO.
The Department of Extra Normal Operations.
Operations. Had a same kind of general feel to it, and I, you know, like I said, those two books were awesome.
And they did incorporate some of those elements from the TV show, like the Danvers family is involved
yep.
in the book, though they're not Kara's adoptive parents necessarily. They weren't introduced mm-hmm. to her through Superman. They were actually introduced to her through the DEO.
Yeah.
and you also have her adoptive sister. Mm-hmm. So all of those elements are in there, but that actually has, I feel like it's really going to work for the show, or for the comic. And I was really surprised at how Lor Vaughn worked for me. I didn't expect him to. The Kryptonian werewolf. That's a concept that I've never been a big fan of, and
right.
I was apprehensive about it being in this comic. But seeing how they did it, I was like, okay, this doesn't suck in the way that it was done before. So I am, I'm not hating that at all. I'm still far more intrigued by the Cyborg Superman story that's coming up in the main arc. So that there's plenty for me to look forward to in that. Anyway, my last top book is. This is going to be a shocker, folks. I want you to reach down and hold on to something, because loyal listeners know that I have not had a lot of praise for this book. In fact, I have, on the Rebirth special that featured one Mr. Greg Phillips, who is going to get mentioned a little bit later in this show as Kelly Returns Fire, and Ms. Jennifer Smith, we talked about what was working for us in Rebirth and what wasn't after the first month. And The Flash was one of those books that just wasn't really hitting for me. It was at the bottom of the pile, really, for all three of us. But I'm happy to report that The Flash number 5 was a almost 180-degree about-face and has made my top 2 of the last 2 weeks. So, yeah, The Flash number 5. This issue, I'm going to butcher this lady's name. I know I'm going to. But it features Mina DeJuan, if you will, the fastest woman alive. She doesn't actually have a code name yet. Hopefully she winds up getting one, because she's featured at the beginning of the book. The book is mostly told from her perspective, with Barry more as a supporting character. And the book was so much stronger for it. Like, Josh Williamson nailed her voice, made her a compelling character, and even gave her some tremendous scenes with the New 52 Wally West. This was what I wanted to see out of a Flash book. And another thing that's helping it is Felipe Watanabe is the penciler on the book. He's the artist stepping in, and it's so much better. This was like a revelation on art for this title. It has not looked this good since it's like from the Rebirth special through every issue up to now. It has kind of struggled for me. It's definitely been a struggle to read sometimes, because I thought the art was just a little too busy. But this nails everything I wanted to see in a Flash book, from tone to character voices, the flow of it, the look of it, the smell of it, the texture, everything about this. It was gold. So yes, The Flash number 5, my next top book of the week, or top 2 weeks, sorry, I keep doing that, but I'm shocked that it got there. I walked in expecting to hate it. I walked out loving it. So,
nice.
That brings us to I'm going to go ahead. I say we do honorable mentions before we get to the crap, Kelly, or what we call the bottom. And I'm not going to go into any great detail on any of these. But I got 3 books that, like we were talking about off air, I was struggling to pick my top 2 or to narrow it down, because there was a lot of quality that came out these last 2 weeks. But I got to give shouts, honorable mentions to Wonder Woman number 5, Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 3, and A Titans number 2. All 3 of those continue to be just the quality books. All 3 of those actually were strong contenders for my top 2. I'm very pleased with everything coming out of there. So, Kelly, what's next up for you? You got another top book, or are we on to your honorable mentions next?
I'll just throw out a honorable mentions wise. I do agree. I think Titans is definitely a good book. I think, you know, I've enjoyed it, but I'm a Titan fan. So, I mean, sure. Teen Titans, Titans, I mean, it to me, I'm just happy to be reading a Titans book that doesn't make me want to just rage. As, you know, we kind of referred back to the New 52, Teen Titans never felt very like it was – it just didn't feel right. It was never, to me, a strong book.
It wasn't.
And Titans, you know, here we are in issue 2, still feels like, wow, they've done – they finally got it – you know, they got it right. And that's –
Does it feel to you like it could be Young Justice season 3?
It could be. It could be. Right. I've read some comparisons to that, and it does feel like it could be that it, you know, it just has a good feel to it. And I'm really hoping that Teen Titans, which is I think going to be out here soon, I hope it has just the same kind of feel to it.
Yeah, you know? That lighthearted kind of fun feel, you know. Kids, mm-hmm. kids being superheroes. That's what we want.
Yep.
Well, it doesn't have to be complicated. You got any more honorable mentions you want to throw up?
I want to say I think, you know, new Green Lanterns, of course, is still a great book. I've been so happy with that book. Just the, you know, it's difficult to kind of put partnerships together in a comic. You know, you really have to kind of – you don't want it to feel forced. You don't want it to feel like that, yeah, we're just doing this to, you know, make a buck. You don't want to feel like it's there's no emotion or feeling behind it. But Simon and Jessica just – they're such really good – and I never – I hated Simon when they first introduced him. I really did. I was like, we don't need another Earth Lantern. It wasn't anything other than the fact that we have now more Earth Lanterns than, you know, but the character grew on me. And of course the writing had a lot to do with it, but, this book is just, it's just a good book. I mean, these two characters are flawed. They're messed up. And I, you know, at the same time, they're both like, look, get up, come on, we got to do this. You know, you can do it. Come on. You know,
They're learning to push each other and learning to lean on each other too.
Yeah, and I want to know what this Emerald Sight is that that Simon's automatically just. I mean, he's starting to kick this ability that I've never seen before in any Green Lantern book. You know.
Yeah, I'm kind of tripped out on that. Like he's kind of seeing the future, maybe. That's mm-hmm. that's the way it looks, or a possible future.
Yeah, but he doesn't have the Sword of Omens, so I don't know how he's you know.
We're not going there. Although there is a He-Man Thundercats crossover coming up that some 80s fans are for sure tripping out about.
That's
a DC book. That,
yeah. Well, I guess does the DC's got the rights to the He-Man franchise and
yep. and Thundercats.
I guess you know, that was funny because I thought for some reason I thought IDW had picked up that franchise, but I guess they didn't.
DC's been running a He-Man book for a while. Did that? I think it was a Eternity War or something, or Eternity
yeah.
War. I guess that was making some He-Man fans pretty happy. I don't know. I didn't read it, but I've known that they've had those books going for a bit. So that's
I knew. Image back in the day had Thundercats for a while. Now, when I say back in the day, I mean like back in the 90s, they had, you know.
The way back when now.
Way back. Well, I think it was that 90s nostalgia that kind of, it's like when Dreamwave brought Transformers back in the fold. And like, oh my God, you know, that was, you know, Dreamwave Entertainment just knocked it out of the park with Transformers. So it was. That's why we had all these other books that come out was because, hey, we got to get some 80s stuff out there. You know?
Yeah. Next up, we need an Airwolf and a Knight Rider series.
Didn't they try Knight Rider a while back, and it was
Yeah, I think so, and that one kind of fell off. But you know what? I think the time's right for Airwolf. I think there might actually be a series of that coming out, if I remember right.
Well, you're not going to get – Ernest Borgnine's passed away, and yeah. Jan Michael Vincent is either dead or he – the last time I saw him in an interview, he looked horrible. he's had a rough life.
Yes.
I feel for the guy. I mean, but I mean, I was like, wow.
If ever there was a show that needs like a real documentary on it, I think we need an Airwolf documentary. I need that in my life.
Yeah,
it would make me so incredibly happy. I'd be six again. All right, now we're gonna move on to the bad part of the show.
Yeah.
The part where we pick the bottom two books. And
let's reiterate this. It's not always that these books are horrible.
It's not.
It's just that if you have a list and you make your comics and you kind of put them in a list, so to speak, from best to kind of, you know, not worst, but, you know, from top to bottom, these books are at the...
This is the bottom.
The bottom of the box, you know. Yep.
And once again, for me... I'm not going to say it's a bad, like Kelly just said, it's not a bad comic. It's just not a particularly great comic either. And it should be. It's Justice League number 3. Once again, I will say this for it. I enjoyed this issue more than I enjoyed issue 2. I thought it moved the story forward well enough. The dialogue got maybe just a smidge better, but not by a noticeable degree for the most part. And Tony Daniels' art still looks good. But at the same time, I don't know. I just feel like it's a story that I've seen, that it doesn't really push any kind of boundaries. It doesn't feel like, you know, the kind of Justice League story that I was expecting from Brian Hitch, especially since his JLA has had that kind of feel and that kind of like grand epic scale high stakes type of storytelling. And funnily enough, issue 9 of that finally came out this past Wednesday. I picked that up, and it was funny because I read that and then I went back and I looked at Justice League number 3. I'm like, man, does Hitch just need more time? Is that what it is? Like, is it a time thing? Because JLA number 9, while not an amazing book or anything, was far better than Justice League number 3.
Yeah.
So, and that's, man, I don't know what it's going to take to really kick this book into high gear, but I hope that it will finally get there. I mean, if Flash can finally do it after 5 issues, that shows me that, you know, maybe I will be sticking around. I'm going to wait. Like I said before, Justice League is nowhere near bad enough for me to just drop it straight from my list.
Yeah.
But it is also not great enough for me to look at somebody who is working on a tighter budget than me and for me to recommend you buy that book.
Yeah.
So I, despite the fact that there's a big crossover coming up that we're going to talk about a little bit later, I'm still not going to say, hey, go get Justice League. That should be on your pull list. I'm going to say that's probably one you can pass over. Now, that said, Kelly, what's your first bottom book?
Again, I'm pulling from the same kind of page that I did last time we talked, and it's Earth 2 Society Annual. Now, the thing is, this was a really good story. You know, it was definitely a father and son story. I really don't want to go into a lot of detail because I don't want to turn people off from this book. I really think Earth 2 Society is a great series, and I think that if you're looking for kind of your JSA fix, this is your book, of course. But it, to me, it just felt stale in some regards. It just didn't hit me like previous issues did. You know, and that to me, I want a book to really come in and make me, you know, you want some enjoyment, you want some sort of emotional reflex from reading this book, and this book didn't have it. I was kind of like at the end of it, I was like, Okay. You know, on to the next book.
You get to the end of it, and it's like, that was a comic.
That was a comic. You know, and the art's really good in this. I mean, they've got some you know, fantastic people working on it art-wise. But again, I'm still going to stick with it, but it didn't wow me. And, you know, it was like, well, you can't expect every book to wow you. Well, you know what? When you're you want it to at least pull something out of you.
Yeah, you want to have kind of emotional response.
Right, right. When if you pick this book up and you read it cover to cover, and at the end of the when you finally flip that last page over and you're just kind of like, and you don't have any, then that book hasn't done its job. And you know, it doesn't have to be some earth-shattering rosebud moment, but it just has to be like you get something. I mean, to me, like an example was like in Blue Beetle, where you have that dialogue between Ted and Jaime, and he's like, you know, because he's kind of the reluctant hero. He goes, I just want this thing off me. You know, I've got to get to class. You know, I can't be doing this. And the whole time I'm just laughing. I'm like, God, this kid just doesn't know what he's got. And that's kind of what Ted's thinking too. He's like, look, we got stuff to do.
I'm going to turn you into a superhero yet.
Right. We've got our mobile bat lab. We've got our mobile bat cave, you know, because he showed him the bug.
It's like, he's fly around on a giant bug.
You know, which is, when I saw the bug, I was like, yes, so much, so much yes. Now we just need to get yourself in your outfit and we'll be good to go. But yeah, that's the thing is a book doesn't have to, like I said, just knock you out of the park, but you've got to get something out of it. And when a book doesn't, it kind of comes down to the bottom of the box, basically.
And that's where I was, you know, with Earth 2 there for a while. That's probably why I didn't follow it into Earth 2 Society, because I was really turned off by the whole Future's End event.
Yeah.
Not Future's End, yeah. I guess that, and World's End. World's End was the one that...
World's End, yeah.
Future's End was a different set, and that was a whole other thing. But anyway, we'll leave that there, and I'll move to my final bottom book, and this is kind of surprising because I was really looking forward to this. We talked about how we didn't record last week because it was that rare third week, and there weren't a ton of books that came out, honestly, but some did, and one of them was this Suicide Squad Special War Crimes, and this is by John Ostrander, a guy who is responsible for the modern iteration of the Suicide Squad. If you're familiar with those characters and you know what the Suicide Squad is, it's likely due to the work that John Ostrander did back in the mid and late 80s. And he had a storied run on that title. And those stories actually really hold up. I encourage you to go get those now that they've been reprinted in trade format. So I was expecting something really good out of this one-shot special that doesn't really have any bearing on the main Suicide Squad book or any kind of continuity whatsoever. But as I read it, I realized that this book has no real substance. It's about as surface as it gets. As far as the individual voices of the characters, I just did not feel like Ostrander had a handle on it. I felt like most of the characters read exactly the same. Like, you know, it's not done well when Deadshot and Rick Flagg and some character named Mad Dog all read like they're the same character. And even are rendered at some points in the art looking almost exactly alike. And I was like, that's not good. Like, you can't have that. They all should have distinct voices, and they just really didn't. It was also like really painfully predictable whose head bomb was going to go off, you know, before the end of the issue, and you knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And once again, another writer trying to handle Harley Quinn and having no idea how to write her voice. I don't blame Ostrander too much for that, because I don't feel like he has... I don't think he's had any experience writing Harley Quinn, so this might have actually been his first time trying that.
I think so. I don't...
Yeah, I can't... I don't blame him too hard for that, because, you know, if it's your first crack at writing Harley Quinn and you only did it because you were, like, told you had to include her in the team...
Yeah.
You're probably not going to have, you know, much of a direction for her, and she's really inconsequential to the overall story. But that's how this whole thing felt. It felt completely inconsequential, and like I genuinely felt after I read it that I wasted my money, and it's a $4.99 book, so it's definitely not one that I'm very happy about. So if it were announced that John Ostrander was going to get a Suicide Squad ongoing, I might still give it a look just because it's him, but this little special did nothing to make me want to go and actually read any more of his, like any modern Suicide Squad from him. I think I'll just go and read his stuff from the 80s and I'll be happy there, and I'll probably keep reading the main Suicide Squad book now. But yeah, the Suicide Squad War Crimes special was by a long measure the worst book I read the last 3 weeks.
Do you think that he's been so far away from this allotment of characters that maybe he's kind of lost touch or lost a connection to them, their voice, that maybe, you know, they threw him a bone, said, hey, let's get him to do this, and maybe he didn't.
Or yeah, it could be that. It could be that, you know, they were reprinting his stuff, and he said, hey, that's really cool. Would you guys mind if I, like, took a crack at something? Or maybe they liked the idea of him writing something to do with Suicide Squad, since, you know, he did.
Yeah. He put it on the map.
Yeah, he put Suicide Squad on the map. He's responsible for us knowing what that team, who Task Force X is.
Right.
If it were not for John Ostrander, we wouldn't have... you know, Deadshot being so out front right now, we wouldn't have, you know, the Suicide Squad movie. None of that. Mm-hmm. None of that would be happening. Yeah. So he's, you know, back in, like, him coming back to DC, I was hyped. I was thinking this could be cool, but the results were less than stellar. So I think the time away may have affected it. Maybe he just doesn't really have, you know, a lot of Suicide Squad stories to tell, at least with these characters. Like, if he were to put together his own version of Suicide Squad right now, it might work better. That'd be nice to do.
I mean, I could understand him not knowing Harley, because there was no Harley Quinn in his lineup, and it may have just been, okay, I've got a writer. Okay, here, I'm just going to do this shit.
Yeah, it's like, if he were to do the Suicide Squad his way, like with his lineup, it might work out better.
Yeah. Bring in some Bronze Tiger.
Why not? Why not? Is anybody doing anything with Bronze Tiger right now? No.
No.
He's not doing anything at all, so why not? I mean, we haven't seen that guy in forever. You know that? Mm-mm. That would be fun to bring in. Kelly, you got another bottom book for us?
Yeah.
One more.
Micronauts number 5. Now, Micronauts is a series put out by IDW based on a toy line that came out in the early 70s, 74, 70, no, 75, I think. Mm-hmm. It's based on a Japanese toy line that came out in 74. And later, Mego... it's a company that I think it was 76 that they ended up getting the licensing to bring these figures. And of course, here I'm going to plug the 70s again of being just the best time to be a kid. I mean, I bought these figures and things, and even Marvel ran a comic book series based on the Micronauts from like 76 into the 80s. I mean, it ran for several years. And this is the 5th issue. It's done by, Cullen, is it Cullen Bunn? Is that how you say it?
Yeah,
Cullen Bunn. And Max Dunbar. which I really enjoyed it. But this last issue, again, kind of like with the Suicide Squad, I don't want to go into a lot of spoilers because, you know what, I want folks to look at like, because I want people to try other books. And this is one of those ones that when I saw Micronauts, I didn't even know it was out. I didn't even know IDW had the rights to the property. When I saw issue one sitting on the shelf there at Fanatics here in Enterprise, I went, wow, what the hell is this shit? Well, I'm buying this. You know, and
coming home with me now.
Yeah, I was like, this is awesome. And like I said, every issue has been pretty cool. But this last issue, I was just like, I got through reading it. I kind of felt the same way I did with her, too. I was just like,
okay. That reaction all right. is now that's Kelly's default reaction now. That's his middle of the road reaction. Do it again. There it is.
That's it. I mean it, and I want you know the listeners out there to check this book out. I mean it's pretty fun. It's a pretty fun book. The art's really good. It's kind of, you know, it's sci-fi fantasy kind of, you know, and I, you know, like I said, if you want to know about the Micronauts, of course, you know, Wikipedia, you can learn all you want to about it, but it's one of those, like for me, I think that as far as books go, this last issue just is like, what's that term? Phoning it in. It just got phoned in. Which is, you know, terms for,
And, you know, speaking of Cullen Bunn and all things, what's that noise you make? All things that. We're heading on into the news topics, our news points for this week. That, of course, closing out our top to bottom two picks. And hope you guys enjoy that. I know that we don't talk about a lot of Marvel books on this show, but real quick before we head on to the news points, I will say that I'm reading a ton of Marvel stuff, actually, through the wonderful and illustrious Marvel Unlimited app. I mean, $69.99 a year, and I'm binge reading right now a whole bunch of different stuff, including the current Star Wars books. They've just started adding in like all the really good series post 2015 Secret Wars, like Old Man Logan, best damn superhero comic on the shelf, and the adjectiveless Spider-Man, as well as Amazing Spider-Man, and Extraordinary X-Men is another good one. All New Wolverine, gonna give that one a good plug. I like that book, and I'm also doing a good binge read of Ultimate Spider-Man. Actually, for a very good reason, and we're not going to announce a ton of details on this just yet, but be on the lookout for an Ultimate Spider-Man special coming up. So yeah, there's going to be plenty of Marvel representation on the show as we go forward. But speaking of Marvel, I say all that to bring us to this part right here where I don't have a lot of praise. Kelly, our first news item, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there was a lot of teasers that came out over the last like couple weeks. A metallic MU logo that Marvel put out with Cullen Bunn's name attached and a whole bunch of artists who had either worked on X-Men books or worked on Wolverine books. And with that metallic MU, it kind of felt like maybe we were getting like maybe a Mutants United book. Like that's the way it felt. But no. No. It turned out to be Monsters Unleashed.
Sorry.
That's actually the proper noise, and your other noise works for this one as well. That was the noise that perfectly fit this one.
Monsters Unlimited. Did you say Monsters Unlimited or
Monsters Unleashed?
Unleashed. What are we going to do? A giant Groot, Zemu. I mean, things that are irrelevant.
It comes from a. There was a black and white horror magazine called that same thing that Marvel published back in the mid 70s, and it featured Man-Thing, like yeah. Frankenstein's Monster, and other stuff like that. I'm not feeling this. I'm really not. Like, after all that, like, teasing and build-up, and then they drop that, and you know what? This is all the time I want to spend on it, because that's all it's worth.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of bullshit. And you know what? Screw whoever came up with that idea and thought it was cool to, like, tease everybody with it and think that, oh, we'll just drop Monsters Unleashed on them. They're totally going to buy the book now, right? Nope. I'm going to call it right now. Canceled in less than a year.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to, you know, I'm going to agree with you. I think, why Marvel? I mean, Man-Thing, poor man's Swamp Thing,
basically,
you know, I mean, and if you want to put the two characters side to side, Swamp Thing is a lot more of a character than Man-Thing is. I mean, as far as just in, you know, depth and scope and magnitude, as far as, you know,
and can they even use, I don't know if they'll use Frankenstein's monster, but I don't think they can, because DC has that character kind of on lock, or at least a version
yeah.
of it. So they,
Frankenstein might be public domain, though.
That's true.
I mean,
might be a thing that they can just do, and it's not really that big a deal. And it's not, but...
Yeah, exactly. So the MU's not not worth really the time.
It's not. Moving on to something that's going to be a little bit cooler, because, Kelly, you're gonna love this one. I know this was one that you're particularly excited about now. Dynamite and DC are teaming up again, just like they did with the... if people remember, they did a Batman 66 meets the Green Hornet series. Well, now they're doing a Wonder Woman 77 meets the Bionic Woman.
Yes.
And that's got to tickle all of Kelly's fancies.
Well, I mean, again, I am a kid of the 70s. That's when I grew up, and of course, I'm going to plug it again. 70s was the time to be a kid, and you know, Wonder Woman as a TV show was something I watched very religiously, and you know, the Bionic, the $6 Million Man, and Bionic Woman, of course. I mean, both those shows I watched with my dad. So I mean, it was some good stuff. And seeing, you know, this comic series, Wonder Woman 77, is you know, DC is. They saw the writing on the wall with how popular Batman was when they did the Batman series, of course, after the TV show back in the 60s. So it makes a lot of sense, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think this is another potential winner, because the Wonder Woman 77 book has been good. Andy Mangels is going to be writing this. He did some work on, like, the Dark Horse Star Wars books, some Star Trek titles, and the X-Files. So he's been around, been doing this for a little bit, and Alex Ross is going to be coming in to do some covers on this. So,
you know, I mean, you can't beat that, then.
No, like, for that alone, it's probably worth picking up, just for those beautiful Alex Ross covers. And they've already got one out that it is every bit as awesome as you would have expected it to be. That classic looking Alex Ross photorealism. Man, he's been doing a lot of work lately. He's also doing all the Amazing Spider-Man covers, and even though I'm not a big fan of the direction they've gone in that book, I gotta give him the covers. Those are just damn fine.
I mean, he's in demand when it comes to that. I mean, I'd love for him to sit down and do a full-blown work, but, I mean, if you're making bank just doing covers, I mean, you know, why not, I guess, you know?
And his cover work is probably the best in the biz. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's top-notch. He, by far, is and probably will be my favorite artist, just because of the time and effort, and just, you know, of course, the realistic look of everything that he does.
Sure.
So.
And with that, we move on to a quickie item, something that was kind of cool. We saw Ben Affleck teased us all on Twitter by dropping that wonderful Deathstroke introduction, which is likely signaling that Deathstroke is going to be in Justice League. don't know to what capacity, but we know that he's likely going to be there. And it's also been said that like shortly after, in this past week, we had Stephen Amell of Arrow fame say that there's nothing stopping them from also using Deathstroke, who was played amazingly by Manal Bennett.
Oh yeah.
On Arrow again, like they could totally bring him back. And he even said that the film side have not told them they couldn't do it. They're not standing in their way. They just have to come up with a time and a story to bring the character back. And there's nothing to say that those two characters couldn't coexist either. Like they could exist alongside each other at the same time. And you know what? I'm glad he said that to kind of shoot down that idea that, oh, film side comes in and tells the TV people who they can and can't use. You know, that I was glad to have that put to rest.
Yeah.
And to know that Deathstroke is still a possibility for Arrow, because he's still by far the best villain they ever had on the show.
Yeah, I mean the actor, again, like you were saying, I mean, just top notch. I mean, knocked it out of the park. Reminded me in a lot of ways of Michael Rosenbaum's portrayal of Lex in Smallville. I mean, just from, you know, the first time he stepped out and you saw him, and I was like, that guy's Lex, you know. So it's good when the casting is kind of just when they nail it like that.
Oh yeah, like he's one of my absolute favorites, and I hope that the tease that we're going to see somebody who hasn't been on Arrow for a good while winds up being him. I really want it to be Deathstroke, because his presence has been sorely missed on the show since he left. And one more item, or a couple more items that we wanted to talk about. One in particular is we've got our first big Rebirth event is coming up. Justice League versus Suicide Squad. That's going to be a big one. It's being described as the end of Rebirth Phase 1. And it's going to be written by Joshua Williamson, who's currently writing The Flash. And Tony Daniel is actually going to be in on the main Justice League versus Suicide Squad book. And Jason Fabok is actually going to be joining the main Suicide Squad title to draw the tie-in issues for it. So this has all sorts of good stuff to bring me in. I'm totally in with this idea of the Justice League has discovered that the Suicide Squad exists, and they have decided to remove them, if you will. They have decided that that's not going to fly anymore. And all of this is actually kind of spinning out of events that have happened across several different DC books, but of course the main titles being Justice League and Suicide Squad, with a miniseries that's going to run in December and January. So, Kelly, any thoughts on that?
No. I mean, I think you summed it up. I mean, it's good.
Not here. All right. He is articulate as always, folks. he's got his pull list made. I know that this one's going to wind up on your list.
I'm definitely going to pick it up.
So I know Kelly well enough to know what he's going to buy, and this is one of them. So I'm pretty pumped for that. I think that's going to be a cool thing to do, and I'm glad that they've got it, you know, sectioned out like this. Like Rebirth is taking place over the course of like 2 years, and this is the end of Phase 1. So after this, we move into, you know, whatever that next phase is going to be. But we have to, now that the hero, as Jeff Johns put it, now that all the heroes are kind of on the board and in good places again, they're putting their villains back in place. And this is, it's called Justice League versus Suicide Squad, but it's going to wind up being a team-up story, because apparently there is a bigger villain in the mix. And that's also going to lead to the spinoff book, JLA, which is going to be written by Steve Orlando. They haven't announced an artist for this yet, but We've been waiting a while for that Justice League of America book to launch since it was part of the initial Rebirth announcement way back when. And months and months go by, and we just never see a solicit for it, but they finally announced that it's going to start in February.
That's good. I mean, you know, finally.
Yeah, it's like we've taken long enough to get there. And the lineup of it is going to spin directly out of this event, so I guess we're going to see some lineup changes possibly coming to Justice League and maybe to Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
So
just don't add Aztec.
but we could always go for
sorry for any Aztec fans out there, but
all five of you. And who probably haven't discovered this show yet, but they will now because you know that they're out there looking for any mention of their favorite character. But I would totally be, Kelly subtweeting like that. I would totally be good with them adding like Elongated Man or something. I think that would be cool. I'd like to see Ralph Denby come on over from his kind of interesting turn in Secret Six at the end of the New 52.
He's supposed to be making appearances in the that Powers TV show on NBC. I thought I read something.
Yeah,
the other day.
I just hope that show doesn't suck as much as I think it's going to.
I got a feeling it's not going to. It's on NBC.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I have no faith. You know, they manhandled Constantine and now it's going to flop.
They
can't do it.
It's another faux documentary style comedy that I'm just not. I'm not into that.
You can't get a real character done when you can't do, you know, you can't do Constantine justice, that you can't give him a fair stake in the TV world. Nah, this show.
No.
I don't know if it does turn out, you know, to be a popular show and it breaks out, then, you know, I'll grow, but I think it's going to flop.
Yeah, I'm giving it. I don't think it makes it to midseason. But anyway, that brings us to the end of that. But we may consider Powers the next time we do our bottom five TV comic book adaptation TV shows of all time. Who knows? It may be a contender.
Yeah.
But anyway, our last item, we'll try not to spend a ton of time on this because we're kind of running a shorter time here in this first half. But recently, this is a fair warning, folks, this is going to be a little bit of a controversial subject, but me and Kelly both got thoughts on this one. Recently, a book from Marvel called Nighthawk was canceled due to low sales, which is the death knell for many a comic. And it's part and parcel for the industry. It's always been that way. It'll always be that way because it is a sales-driven business. I mean, the business of comics is to make money, of course. And Nighthawk wasn't making money. It wasn't selling. The book's writer, David Walker, who is a very talented writer, who's done plenty of good work before, he even said on Twitter that he understood that he felt Marvel was supportive of the book, that it just didn't take off, and that happens sometimes. But in the wake of this, there have been a ton, and I mean a ton, of just stupid, awful, terribly written think pieces, and I put that in quotations, by the way. There it is. From people who I'm not going to name because they don't deserve recognition for their work, but one of them works for a website that implies that he's not aware of how wonderful indoor plumbing is, and in fact has to go to one of those places outside his house to defecate, or in this case to write his horrible articles, which is probably one and the same activity, honestly. And he implied in a recent article that it was time for the comics industry to die completely because this book got canceled. And I gotta tell you, that was one of the most asinine, poorly researched, poorly reasoned, and just straight up idiotic things I have ever read. And when it was over, I was like, you know what? Yeah, it does suck whenever a good book gets canceled. We've all experienced it. We'll all experience it again. But folks, the one thing that you could do, the one thing that you could really do is, you know, spread that word. If you're loving a book that much, get off your ass and tell people about it. You know, tell people about it at your comic book shop. You know, real face-to-face word of mouth. Tweet about it. Post about it. I don't know. Maybe write a whole blog about it. You know, do that. And yeah, it should. Marvel should spend more time promoting some of these books that are really good. But the thing is, I've seen promotions for plenty of books. Like, there was a book from DC called Threshold that was actually a pretty good book. And I went back and looked through several of their issues, and man, they, before that book came out, they were pushing the hell out of it. They were really trying to get that book to sell. It didn't. Yeah. It made it 8 issues.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, I couldn't say that they didn't promote the book. Oh, yes, they did. They did the same thing for Larfleeze, and that was another book that didn't make it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Marvel is promoting these books. That is happening. They're promoting it in the same way that they promote anything else. But when a book doesn't catch on, you can't put all of the responsibility on the publisher. You do have to look over at the fans and ask them, hey, this book is actually very good. Critics are acclaiming it. It's getting a lot of good free press. Why are you guys still ignoring it? And the answer is typically because they don't know who this character is. And even if you've got a stellar book, quality ain't always going to translate to sales. And dem's just the breaks.
I have always thought that before you give any character his own format, his own book, that you really need to make sure your comic book audience knows who this character is. And Nighthawk is one of those characters that, I mean, if you go back and you Wikipedia him, he's got a long, convoluted kind of, you know, there's different versions of him on different Earths. This current one they're talking about is more from the Squadron Supreme universe. And, you know, to me, it wouldn't have hurt them to, when they did this new series, to almost maybe reintroduce him to the comic book world and say, hey, this is who Nighthawk is. Let's give you a little backstory. Let's get you caught up. And sometimes that could help. You know, I mean, it doesn't hurt to kind of give an issue or two of backstory or kind of set things up to you know, get new players in there. But
and maybe put him in a book that is going to sell a little bit better than, you know, Squadron Supreme.
Yeah, of course, I still read that book and love it, but I know it's the death knell is you know,
it's coming.
It's coming. And, you know, why not put this character in one of your Avenger books or put him in one of your big books where he's going to get some notoriety and get some face time with some of the other big wigs in the Marvel U and set him up. I mean, because he's really a cool character, and I've always enjoyed him. I've always been a big fan of, again, here's my – loving the underdog, the C-list group Squadron Supreme, which is basically a Marvel's version of the Justice League. You know, I just hate to see books like that. And that's the thing, too, is that people complain that there's no new books out or there's nothing new. Yeah, there is. You just have to, as a comic book fan or reader, go, okay, you know what? I'm going to step outside my comfort zone. I'm going to pick up a new book today. I'm going to try something new. I'm not just going to feed off DC and Marvel, you know, as...
Or even if you're going to the DC and Marvel trough again, try one of their books that you've ignored up to now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Try something different. I mean, there are good books out there. There are books that come out every month. If you look through previews, I mean, there's a ton of new stuff. But you've got to get outside your comfort zone. And a lot of comic fans they're unwilling to, they're too static. They want to stay just in their comfort zone and everything's, nah, I can't do that. And if you're always complaining that there's nothing new to read, then you need to do that. You need to get outside that and start looking at new books.
And totally look around at your local comic shop, because I guarantee you that even if the owner isn't this person, there's somebody that frequents that shop, every shop, who is like a walking encyclopedia of knowledge and will point you to where the good books are.
I am at Fanatics just about every Wednesday, usually from 1 to around 3 o'clock. And Fanatics is here in Enterprise. Owner Mike is a great guy. But, you know, if you're ever out on a Wednesday, I mean, I'll be glad to give you my opinion about what's good and what you should pick up or what's different and that kind of stuff. I mean, and even if it's not me, if you're whatever your local comic shop is, talk to some of the people there, you know, and get a see what they're reading. Say, hey, what are you reading? And you know, strike up a conversation. I mean,
it's a great way to make friends.
It's a great way to make friends, and it's a great way to find out the truth of what's good. I mean, you can sit and read reviews all day, but you talk to the people in the trenches that are there, and they're, you know, these fans, another fan like yourself, they're going to give it to you straight. You know, they're not going to try to sugarcoat it for their website or to get, you know, favor for this from this publisher or that publisher. They're just going to say, hey, look, this is what I'm reading, and this is why, and, you know, I recommend it.
Yeah, exactly. Like you got to go and do that, and that way you won't miss out. You know, you stand a better chance of not missing out on something. And Kelly, before we take a break, why don't we tell the folks about our new segment that's going to be coming up? Since we're pretty excited about this one, folks. This is going to be a cool thing that's going to be coming up. I believe we're doing this next month, aren't we? Yeah.
October is going to be our maiden voyage for this new segment, and I'm
tell them what it's called, Kelly.
It's called The Mist and the Maligned, and I have already got three or four. I've done my research on it, so I've already got books lined up to put into this category for the next several segments. We're not going to run short of material for this segment. It's basically, you know, books that have either been missed out, people didn't read, or books that have been, you know, maligned, basically. Unfairly hated on. And, you know.
And there'll probably be a lot of books that were just missed. Like we'll get to some maligned stuff, too. But and it's not just comic books. It's also TV shows. It's movies. It's comic book characters. It's everything. The Mist and the Maligned could be anything. But since it's going to be debuting in the third week of October, pretty close to Halloween, we thought we'd go with a good Halloween theme.
Yeah.
So we're going to be talking about a little book that Kelly and I love deeply. It's from Dark Horse Comics called Beasts of Burden. It was written by Evan Dorkin, drawn by Jill Thompson. We will talk in depth about that book when the first edition of The Mist and the Maligned debuts, third week in October. But
can't wait.
That's going to be good. But, folks, stick around. Stick around, because after the break, Kelly and I are going to come back, and we're going to hit you with the definitive top five live-action comic book TV shows ever. That's right, ever. We determined it. We are the authority. We are the authority. And as you know, Place to Be Nation fans, the authority always wins. And with that, we are going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk all about these TV shows. So stick around, and we will see you very shortly.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO-PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners, as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Place to Be Nation, we are back. It's the second half of the Sellers Points Top 5 live action comic book TV shows ever. Because like I said before the break, we are the authority, and the authority always wins. And we have made the determination of what the best live action comic book TV shows ever are. But before we get to that, as we understand it, one Mr. Greg Phillips, in true Richard fashion, decided to send a volley back Kelly's way. And Kelly, you had something you wanted to say to the old Richard. Let him have it.
Well, I think that sometimes it's best just to give some advice and point someone in the right direction. And I think for Greg that he should probably read Eclipso, The Darkness Within. You might look that up. That might change his opinion about Mon-El in a lot of different aspects. It is a very good book. And you know, that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to be kind of, you know, a little less is more situation here. But you know, if it keeps getting, you know, heavy, I might have to break out the big guns.
You know what? I'm all about Kelly breaking out the big guns, and he has got them. He is a Mon-El fanboy like you have never seen. because I can't honestly name you another Mon-El fan.
No, I'm pretty much, I'm really the only one.
That's a,
I mean,
but he's a passionate one.
Yeah. Paul Levitz called me the other day and said, "Thank you so much for loving Mon-El. You're really you're keeping his spirit alive. Thank you so much." And Jim Shooter sent me an email just the other day saying, "You know what? You son of a bitch, you're the only person in the entire world that loves Mon-El, and I don't know why. But hey, you know what? Just keep it going, you know." So
it's really,
you got two endorsements like that. I mean,
officially, unofficially endorsed by imaginary Paul Levitz and Jim Shooter. You know what? I'll take it. I'm all about it. I love both of those guys, and who wouldn't? Really? Greg wouldn't, because Greg's a Richard. But that's a story for another time, another place.
He's a Dick Jones, if you know what I mean.
He works for Dick Jones.
He does.
He works.
Clarence Boddicker.
He's not a Richard now. He's a Clarence. You are Clarence Boddicker, and he works for Dick Jones.
God. These folks are going to, who are these names? Just Google them. I mean, you'll figure out who they are.
Folks, once you discover who Clarence Boddicker and Dick Jones are, your life will be closer to complete.
Yes.
Because that's what completes us. And speaking of complete, let's tell them a little bit about what this little business of the top five live-action comic book TV shows actually is and how we determined it. Because there was some criteria we had to follow. We didn't just sit down and say, okay, well, here's what they are and done. No. This took damn near 3 hours of our time to determine. We had a hell of a long list. And, you know, we might just put that up. You know what? I'm going to put that list up of our nominated shows so people can see how hard it was. So in the description of the episode, you will see the list. And
add any that you, if there's anything that we missed, I mean, I'd love to see people's, hey, you missed this show or you missed this show, you know.
Oh, but remember, they have to follow, but it has to follow the very specific rules.
And the
rule is, as we determined it for each show under consideration, it had to be, of course, an adaptation of a pre-existing comic book property or character. It had to have more... It had to have at least 2 full seasons that have aired on television. So, of course, that disqualifies some newer shows like Jessica Jones, Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl. And the reason we did that, the reason for both rules, is all because of the same show. We were trying to avoid what we dubbed the Heroes effect. As some people will remember, Heroes was a show that ran for 4 seasons on NBC... And
really didn't have to.
Nope, it didn't.
Sorry.
No, that's true. It's true. Because it became a real piece of shit. And the thing is, its first season, and Kelly and I both agreed on this, that it was one of the best first seasons of any TV show ever.
Yeah.
But from season 2 on, it's an unwatchable train wreck just going off the rails. And that right there shows that just because a show has a great first season, or even a great single season, does not mean that it's going to be able to maintain quality. And Heroes did not. But Heroes was also not based on a pre-existing comic book property. So, any shows, just because it was a superhero show, doesn't mean it was eligible. Like, otherwise, Greatest American Hero would have been eligible. And, well, nope. Not that it wasn't a fun show or anything. But I digress. But those were the rules. Like, it had to have at least 2 full seasons that have aired, and it had to be based on a prior existing comic book property.
Yeah.
And some other criteria that we judged these shows on was, what did they do for their characters, and what did they do for the industry as a whole? Like, did they advance these characters in a way that made them more popular than they already were? So, keeping all of that in mind, we determined that these 5 shows really like changed things forever. There's no going back. And I'm never doing a Heath Ledger again because that's just creepy. But we're going to start off with the show. This first show that we're going to talk about was a pretty big one. And we should go ahead and say, folks, these are not in any particular order. We didn't number them 5 to 1 or 1 through 5 or anything like that. Because we looked at these and said, you know what? They're all on the same level. They could all easily, you could make an argument for any one of these being the best comic book adaptation TV show of all time. So we just said, yeah, fuck it. We're not going to put them in an order. We're going to just put these out there to you, and you can put them in whichever order you like. But getting back to the subject, first show was a real, this was a really big one. This is a super important show. Super. There I did it, Kelly. This one started back in, like, what, I believe it was 1953, if I'm not mistaken. This the first show we're talking about is The Adventures of Superman, starring George Reeves. Ran from, let's see, 1952 to 1958. It had 6 seasons. Long, long-running show. And it was one of those shows that started out in black and white, and eventually it transitioned over to color because it was one of those like crossover shows. Like, it was right at the end of black and white television era and right at the beginning of the color television era. First time that a superhero like this had ever been seen on TV. And Kelly, what was you've got even more experience with this show than I do, because I only vaguely remember it as a kid, but I do know the I know the impact that this show had on Superman and his character as you know, as a piece of pop culture. So, yeah, Kelly, what did this show do for you?
Well, I mean, as a, of course, this came out. You know, I was born in '69, so it was, you know, a little bit before my time. But you know, they, of course, they replayed these shows years later. In the 70s, as I was growing up, I would watch the show at my grandparents' house, usually on Sundays, and when we were over there having Sunday dinner or whatever, or Sunday lunch. And I can remember as a kid watching, you know, this show and seeing a comic book character. Of course, I mean, I knew Superman and Batman and Green Lantern and all of them, but I mean, seeing Superman on the screen, fighting bad guys, and the character interaction, you know, you had Jimmy Olsen, you had Lois Lane, you had Perry White, and all of them done by really good actors. You just kind of, it was like the comic book page kind of being brought to the small screen. And you know, I didn't get to see a whole lot of many episodes of it, but I remember a lot of them. I feel like it was almost kind of like you were fighting. Superman was fighting the you know, ground level thugs and you know, crime syndicate type people, not the so called villains from the comic book series. I think they kind of kept it in that. You know, I could be wrong. I mean, he may have fought some of his comic book villains, but I don't remember really seeing any in the episodes that I watched. It was more like, you know, gangsters and thugs and people that would shoot guns at him, and he'd, you know, take the gun and bend it and hand it and back to him and go, okay, you can have that.
I think that was what made the show so endearing to kids, though, because at the time, it really did have the first big special effects that you were seeing on TV, like the flight effects for Superman.
Yeah.
Stuff like that had never been done on TV before. And that these kids were seeing it, seeing, you know, this guy like breaking through walls, bending guns with his bare hands. They would have bullets bouncing off of him. And he did all of this with the most charming personality, because we got to say that if it had been anybody else in the role, I don't know that it would have been as successful, but George Reeves really is the reason this show works.
And the supporting cast, I mean, Jimmy Olsen and Lois Lane, those actors, They've gone on to kind of carry on that. They were happy to be a part of that.
I'm glad you brought that up, especially Lois Lane in this series. She was actually played by two different actresses. Phyllis Coates was the first in the first season, and Noel Neal played her from then on. But I felt like just the episodes that I've seen from both of them, I felt like they both portrayed the character really well. Like they both got that spunky attitude, that really hard-nosed reporter. I mean, sure, they did play up the whole she's easily fooled by Clark Kent's glasses and his his fedora. But honestly, I look back at this take on Clark Kent, this version of him that really was the definition of mild-mannered. He wasn't he wasn't goofy like you see in the Richard Donner Superman movies. He really was just mild-mannered. That was the best way to describe him. He was just a guy who exists. He gets some. He actually has some pretty funny one-liners occasionally, though.
And he had that kind of gentle quality to him that I'm sure made kids more comfortable to go, that's Superman on the screen, And he did a lot of George Reeves did a lot of I want to say PR events, and did a lot of things for the show outside of it.
To showcase
the show and.
That Stamp Day for Superman. That was something mm-hmm. that the U.S. Treasury Department actually put together to promote school savings, saving stamps plans for children.
Mm-hmm.
That little special was actually shown in grade schools in the 1950s. It's the only episode of the series that has entered the public domain, actually.
Yeah.
I believe it was in the season 2 DVD box set of that show. So, but again, it's another one of those that it promoted that program. And that was another thing about Superman back then was he was really a picture of what 1950s America was, or kind of that idealized 1950s America. He was taking on organized crime. He was working side by side with the U.S. government. I mean, it was very clear distinction of who the good guys and the bad guys were. It's a very simplistic type of storytelling, but at the same time, when kids would see that, it caused a resurgence in the comic books as well. Superman comics were suddenly really big again. And that's, another reason that this show is so important is that it pushed that character back to the front of American pop culture again. And his show was probably easily one of the most popular on television. So you run for 6 seasons. That's no joke. For any show, I think very solid run, and probably to this day, outside of animation, it might still be the best live action interpretation of Superman on the small screen. There have been other good ones, sure, but Adventures of Superman. For an entire for multiple generations of kids, George Reeves was the definitive Superman, and for a lot of them, he still is. So that right there says this is impact. That's the impact of this show, and nearly everyone who has played the character since has probably looked back at the George Reeves performance and taken a little bit from it. And I went back and I watched a couple of episodes recently. And I was like, man, Henry Cavill had to have watched at least a little bit of this going into Man of Steel. And certainly in the Ultimate Edition of Batman v Superman, when he's in his Clark Kent guys, I really feel like he was pulling a little bit from George Reeves. I mean, not a ton, but you can tell that it's in there. He's not somebody who is ever going to be forgotten or dismissed. I mean, when it comes to the conversations about Superman, George Reeves' name is always going to come up. So that's my reasoning behind having it in the absolute best five.
Right.
So
definitely.
Anything else you want to add on this show before we move on to the next one?
No, I think we're good.
Cool. All right. Well, the next one is going to be one that is near and dear to Kelly's heart. One that he put his foot down on this one immediately. He was like, this is on the list. There's no question. And I was like, you know what? I'm not even going to fight you on it because I don't want to see you Hulk out on me. It would be the Bill Bixby Incredible Hulk. Kelly, tell the folks about your experiences with this show.
This show was an 80s program. Came on Friday nights here, you know, at least in our affiliate. And I was there pretty much every Friday, you know, watching this this program. The Incredible Hulk, and I know that I had several customers that were on the same page I was, that this show they grew up with. So, I mean, there is kind of a sentimentality to it. And this show just was a story about the human condition and about what happens when you have this thing that's inside you that you cannot control and you cannot get close to people. You cannot, you know, you're just, you know, you're kind of trapped and you're trying to figure out how to stop it, how to get rid of it. And it's a very lonely story. I mean, that's kind of, you know, Bruce Banner, you know, or David Banner. I think they renamed him David Banner in the TV show for some reason.
For really dumb reasons. They did it because the TV execs thought that the name Bruce sounded gay.
Right, right. Yeah,
yeah, it was the homophobic 70s.
Tell that to Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, right.
The show just had, you know, this just this really quaint quality to it. And Bill Bixby, fantastic actor, portrayed, you know, David Banner and was just a really, you know, just a really good pick for the character. And the show didn't have any of your superhero tropes that you know superhero shows have now, where you have actual supervillains show up. This was like he was just dealing with thugs and with really terrible people, bad people, you know, and
sometimes he was just dealing with like you know bad circumstances.
True, that too. And Lou Ferrigno, who portrayed, of course, you know, the Incredible Hulk, the makeup and just his physique. I mean, you were looking at someone's like, that's the Hulk. This guy's the Hulk. I don't want to get this guy mad at me. You know, this, and he, the two of them, I mean, they made the show. The casting, like I said, was really spot on. And I can't, you know, it's one of those shows, if you've never seen it, I'm sure you can find it somewhere. You should at least give it a shot. I mean, it's still holds up to this day.
It really does. It's amazing how well this show still does. I want to say that it's on one of the streaming services. It's on Netflix or Amazon Prime. I mean, it's out there. You can definitely get your hands on this show very easily. And I like how, again, it's another one of those shows that did not use traditional supervillains. It's a show that they didn't want to go that route. They wanted to do a show that felt more like a personal look at an actual human being. Mm-hmm. And that's what Bill Bixby was so good at. Like his ability to deliver lines was just absolutely amazing. Like for his time, for the current day, I think that he's one of the best. But he also had the ability to emote, because that was something that he was going to have to be able to do, especially during the transformation sequences, or during those times whenever he's trying to keep his emotions in check and under control. He's that guy who is very good at projecting how his character was feeling about something.
Yeah.
And he did it in every single, just about every single episode I remember seeing. And I liked how they still made Hulk a pursued character, because that's something that was very true in the comics, that Hulk is like being chased. But in the in the comics, he's being chased by a military, like an obsessive military guy named Thaddeus Thunderbolt Ross. But in the TV show, he is being pursued by a newspaper reporter named Jack McGee, who, you know, after a bad incident that you know, caused the world to think that David Banner was dead, this Jack McGee guy, he doesn't really believe that that's true. So he's out there trying to find out the truth of, you know, what are these creature sightings and what do they have to do with this guy who kind of looks like this supposedly dead scientist.
And he wasn't a bad guy per se. He was just your true blooded news reporter. He just wanted the truth.
Yeah, and he was following these strange incidences that definitely would have been news for the time. I mean, it could have easily been weekly world news material, but at the same time, there were like actual eyewitnesses to these things. So, you know, in a day and age before there were cell phones and everybody carrying around their own cameras, you follow the leads where they go. And this was a good example of that type of show. But we can also say that the show evolved quite a bit as it went along. It became kind of a Marvel heavy show, because they had a couple of made for TV movies that went along with it. And they even introduced other Marvel characters, such as Thor, and in one of my favorite episodes, Daredevil.
Yeah.
I love the scene when Matt Murdock, in like black suited Daredevil guys, meets Bruce Banner and tries to tell him like what his powers are. And he tells him that one of them is that he can read printed word with his fingertips.
Yeah,
and Bruce is like, huh. He grabs a piece of paper, writes something down, and hands it to him. And he just runs his fingers over it, and he says, "It says I don't believe you." Which I thought that was that's the tongue in cheek nature of the show. While it is a very serious and like sad and kind of lonely show, like you said, it never forgets to add in, you know, humor too. Like it has its funny moments, and it's probably the best treatment that Hulk has ever gotten outside of the comics.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely one of those ones where you know the latter Hulk film was better. I mean, the Ang Lee Hulk, that's, you know, that could be a whole, but I mean that one's
maligned for a reason.
Yeah.
Giant poodle.
Ang Lee Hulk and then the Hulk TV series, I mean, it's two different things, but I mean, to me, there's more when you see Lou Ferrigno in the makeup and he's, you know, doing the Hulk stuff. I mean, I never really thought that this, you know, he's going to really hurt anybody. You know, he's just going to try to get out of the situation as best he can. Yeah, if he knocks somebody through a wall, could be messed up. But I mean, you know, in the 70s or, you know, the 80s, you know, the violence was really toned down. So, I mean, you'd see somebody getting thrown around, but, you know, at most you think, oh, well, they probably got a broke arm or a broke leg. You know, it's nothing too bad, but...
No, you never see Hulk murder anybody.
No, you don't see the now you saw him smash stuff,
but you never
saw him, you know, take somebody and rip them apart or, you know, punch them through a wall or that kind of stuff. I mean, it was all pretty tame as far as violence goes.
It was, and there was an intensity to the show, though, that was something that was kind of unparalleled at the time. Especially whenever the transformation scenes would happen, when something would happen to David, and you'd hear it coming, like you could feel it. He'd always be turned away from the camera real quick, but as soon as the camera started panning in, he spins around and his eyes have gone white.
I always felt like he just had the worst luck when it came to just, you know, you run across these folks that are, you know, they're going to fuck with him and they're going to punch him or they're going to do something. I'm like, all right, you're
taking your life in your own hands.
He's going to flip your car, and he's. But that was the fun part of it, because at least twice in an episode you're going to see him Hulk out and do something, you know, Hulkish.
And unfortunately, every time he did it, he had to buy a new shirt, new pants, new shoes. I mean, it's a good thing that he took on odd jobs in pretty much every episode. So it was a good thing that David Banner was so versatile and talented that he could get hired so easily to do these things, because, man, his wardrobe costs had to be astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he hit up every, thrift shop or, Salvation Army that he could, hit to buy just – I'm sure his backpack was full of just backup clothes. You know, it's like, I could Hulk out today. Maybe I won't, but,
I'd say it's probably a guarantee that at some point or another, David Banner just said, screw it, underwear, and started going commando all the time because it just wasn't worth it.
No, I mean, usually his pants, his purple, they really had the purple pants.
They never went there.
Much. No, but I mean, he always had the pants that, he probably always bought a little bit bigger because he knew, someone's going to mess with me or something, and I'm.
There's no amount of elastic in the world that's going to save him boxers. Sorry. Nope. Or I guess it was like he was probably a briefs man, for all we know. But I would say that show also, again, it was another one of those that elevated the character in his comics, too, because around the late 70s, early 80s, Hulk comics were big again. And people were like totally into the Incredible Hulk. And it was because he was so visible. He was out there on TV in a hugely popular show. It ran from, by the way, from 1978 to 1982, running for, let's say, 82 episodes.
They had on the Hulk comic during that time, as seen on TV.
Blurb
on the comic book, cover. Usually someplace it was like, as seen on TV, the Incredible Hulk.
And that's a testament to how popular that show was, and the kind of impact that it had.
Well, Stan Lee really wanted to jump into television. I mean, he really wanted to get Marvel characters on the small screen. Because at the same time, another character, Spider-Man, got his shot at a TV show, didn't really make it, but went, I think, maybe 6 or 7 episodes. They did a Doctor Strange pilot. They did a Captain America pilot. So he was really trying – Marvel was really trying to get TV shows on the small screen to stick. And, I mean, Hulk was just – everything fell into place for that show. Everything with writing, the editing, the casting.
Yeah, it was that show. Like, it hit. It was the – they struck right at the right time, and it was just all the pieces were there, writing, directing, a great cast. It was just magic, and it was a road show. That was another interesting thing about it, is that it was never just in one location. Like, it was constantly moving.
You had two casts. You had, three. You had Lou Ferrigno, Bill Bixby, and the actor who played McGee. But then you had all these guest stars that showed up every episode because, of course, there was no supporting cast, so to speak. Like, you do have on a show where you have like 3 or 4 characters that are on the show every episode.
So it's just a couple steps shy of Bill Bixby having to be a one-man show. And but he pulls it off. Like, he was so good at what he did. And he's one of those guys that I feel like is kind of underappreciated. More people should know about Bill Bixby and give him the proper praise. But that's why Incredible Hulk earns its spot in the top 5 best all time. And on to our next one, another classic show from the mid to late 70s, ran from 1975 to 1979 for 3 seasons. And that would be Wonder Woman, starring Linda Carter. Now this
still gorgeous, still gorgeous.
Oh, she has aged well. She might actually be an Amazon. That would not surprise me. But this show, it predates Incredible Hulk by a little bit, but it did something similar to Incredible Hulk that we were talking about a minute ago. It didn't use traditional supervillains. It was another one of those shows. She was fighting characters like, I think she had some mad scientists, some generic like mob boss thugs, but she also fought like Nazis a couple of times. Yeah. So that
like,
was,
I think it wasn't one of the seasons set in a World War II kind of situation.
I think they did like they flash back to that, of course.
Maybe that was it. But yeah, you're, I mean, she fought Nazis, you know, very well because they're Nazis, and she's Wonder Woman. That's
precisely like she's going to kick ass. But that's the great thing about this show is that at a time when you know, you wouldn't think that you would see a female empowerment show on television, Wonder Woman comes out and isn't just like preaching female empowerment. It is like a legit like female empowerment show that was popular with male and female audiences.
There were no female lead characters in the 70s. You didn't have a female lead show, not that I can remember, except for Linda Carter, Wonder Woman. That was it. It was written well. The scripts were well. You look back at it now, it's kind of dated. Maybe you'd want to say hokey in some regards, but you know what? It's still charming. It's still very much when you look at her, when she does her little twirl and she spins and becomes Wonder Woman, bam. Right from the comic onto the small screen. There
exactly.
You go.
Exactly. It was like the comic book character came to life. And that's why TV audiences gravitated to her. And suddenly, again, in the 70s, the Wonder Woman comic was suddenly very popular again. People were like, hey, we've got to get on some Wonder Woman comics because this TV show was fantastic and now I want to read more about her. And even though they were seeing like supervillains in the comics that they wouldn't have seen on TV, you could really tell that the character in the comic was recognizable to the character on TV.
And one of the scenes that I can remember just like yesterday is where she's holding up these two Jeeps and they're spinning their wheels trying to get away from her. She's just holding up effort. And as a kid, I can remember thinking, God, she's incredible. She's holding up two Jeeps. She's got to be just as strong as Superman. I mean, of course, you're thinking, as for me, I'm thinking as a small kid, with not all the knowledge I have now, but you're seeing this woman hold these two Jeeps up and these guys trying to get away. And she's like, really? You're still pushing the gas? Come on. it's just perfect,
And like you said, Linda Carter was one of the most charming actresses on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of the most charming actresses that has ever been. She embodies that character. And not just for the generation that grew up in the 70s. Hell, man, people still, like, there are young people today, younger than me, who referenced that show, who apparently their parents and grandparents, I guess, showed it to them.
Yeah.
But people are still passing that show along to their kids and their grandkids. It's timeless. It's one of those shows that I don't know that your childhood is complete unless you've seen at least a little bit of it.
Like you were saying, they didn't introduce any... there was no Cheetah, there was no Giganta, there was no...
No Cersei, no Ares.
No Cersei, no Ares. But they did introduce, and I believe Deborah Winger portrayed her, they did introduce Wonder Girl in a two-part episode or whatever, which I think that's the only thing that you really see as kind of something else they brought from the comic, other than Steve Trevor and he was played by Lyle Wagner at the time. And
they did have they also had Etta Candy on the show.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. But I was like surprised when they brought in Wonder Girl because I had just at that time started reading Teen Titans and kind of learning about Kid Flash and Aqualad and Wonder Girl and
Yeah, that was something that the all the DC shows so far, like in back in the day, up to the present, even are doing really well. They're doing that legacy thing because that's a big part of DC Comics, and it's a big part of their characters in every incarnation, is that idea of legacy, of that that younger version of the like older adult heroes. And even back in the 70s, in that Wonder Woman show, they had Deborah Winger playing Diana's younger sister, Drusilla. Who they called Wonder Girl. So it wasn't Cassie. Right. It wasn't Cassie. It wasn't Donna Troy.
No.
But at the same time, it was an incarnation of Wonder Girl. And
Right. It was their TV version. And, I mean, you know, that's still cool because they're taking something from the comic and putting it in there, which that was really, I think, the only, you know, other than Steve Trevor and the other character you mentioned, I think that was about it. I mean, they pretty much just kind of did their own shtick with it, you know.
They totally didn't do any supervillains. They didn't introduce any of the other big DC Comics concepts, because it wasn't like... This show didn't take place in like the same universe as the 1966 Batman show.
And no.
Even though Wonder Woman had some cheese to it, it was never that cheesy.
No. I mean, I like I said, there was some moments you were like, oh, that's kind of... But, yeah.
It went for tongue-in-cheek and subtlety, which is something that Batman 66 does not have. It has plenty of tongue firmly planted in cheek so far that it's sticking actually through the cheek, but it's not really subtle about it. But that's something that the Wonder Woman TV show definitely did, and did really well, as well as some, for the time, it has some pretty kick-ass action in it. So you can't make a top five list without having Wonder Woman in there. That show, it nailed it. It nailed the character perfectly, made the comic really popular again, and to this day it is still referenced as like the, in a lot of people's minds, the definitive version of Wonder Woman. Like, they think of Linda Carter as the definitive Wonder Woman and Christopher Reeve as the definitive Superman, and that's how it goes. Like, she's mentioned in the same breath, so you guys knew that Wonder Woman was totally making this list. But moving on to our next one, this is going to be our first modern day piece on the list, and it's not a superhero show. It's also our first one to not be a superhero show. This is based off of a very popular Image comic series from Robert Kirkman called The Walking Dead. Now, how did this happen? Because while Kelly and I are fans of the show, we do like Walking Dead. We're not as high on it as a lot of other people are. And believe me, there are a lot of people out there who are really high on Walking Dead. Because its ratings are through the fucking roof. And gotta say, Kelly, you can attest to this. This show took off real fast on AMC. And it's still running to this day. It's like, it's about, what, 7 seasons deep now? Mm-hmm. It's been going a while.
This show, I mean, did great for my shop.
I was gonna say, man,
sales of The Walking Dead trades, volumes 1 through 20 something, whatever, 26, 27. I sold more of those trades after that show premiered than any other trade that I ever restocked at my shop. I mean, Walking Dead, for those, you know, few years I still had my shop, I was always reordering it. And it was easy. It was an easy sell because people came in wanting to know, where did this show come from? And it was an easy sell to go, well, here's volume one. This is where it started. Oh, I'll take it. No questions asked. No, I mean, they just wanted it. And I mean, it was, I'm not probably not the only one. I'm sure there's a lot of comic book shops that probably saw a rise in sales from either their back issues, which I didn't have any more back issues. My back issues of Walking Dead got cleaned out as the show progressed. And I just strictly just said, hey, I've got trades. That's all I've got, you know, and people were happy to pick them up.
And if you're one of those folks that got Walking Dead number one when it first came out, you're sitting on a gold mine.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's
that show, and I got to give it this. That first season, especially that first episode, was pretty comic book accurate. They really have brought in pretty much all the major characters from the comic series into the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And done most of them pretty well, with a few exceptions here and there that were, you know, probably wronged in a lot of fans' eyes, Andrea. But other than a couple of little missteps there, I think they actually did some characters better than the comic did, like Shane. I thought Shane was done better in the TV show. He certainly survived longer in the TV show than he did in the comic.
Yeah.
He was dead by the end of the first volume of the comic series, spoiler alert. But John Bernthal played him on the TV show, and now he's playing Punisher on Daredevil and doing a kick-ass job of that. But this show, like Walking Dead, made him a star. Like it made John Bernthal, you know, somebody that we'd all remember. Probably did the same thing for Andrew Lincoln as well, the guy who plays Rick Grimes.
And the little, you know, what's that
Norman Reedus plays Daryl.
Daryl.
And Daryl, yeah. And Daryl is an original creation for the TV show. He does not exist in the comic book world. So whenever I watched,
which I'm sure a lot of readers are probably disappointed in, but yeah,
they probably discovered that they were probably the people who discovered the comic after seeing the show. They were like, "Hey, Daryl's like my favorite character. Why isn't he in this book?" And I was like, "Well, because in the book they didn't need him because they had Tyrese, who was another character who kind of got short shrift on the show, by the way.
Yeah,
because he was my favorite character in the comic. But anyway, but I digress. Still." And see, just because we put the show in the list doesn't mean that we don't have some issues with some of these shows, and it doesn't mean that we consider them to be perfect or like the most entertaining or our personal best. We went by the criteria. We went by what kind of impact did this show have? What kind of impact does it continue to have? Because Walking Dead is still going.
Yeah, I mean, the phenomenon that Walking Dead, you know, we're seeing shows now being created because of what Walking Dead did. Preacher, I think, is a good example.
I think Constantine on NBC was another one that, if it hadn't been for Walking Dead, I don't think they would have aired even that one season of Constantine.
One of my favorites, little known, iZombie, is another one I think that could give Walking Dead a little credit because they, you know,
yeah,
these off the wall kind of comics they could take and put on the small screen and do phenomenal with. And plus, you know, the whole zombie thing I'm sure had a lot of impact on it too. But
no doubt of that. And I'm an iZombie fan too. Like I think that's been a really fun show on CW. Very different, but yeah, it certainly owes some thanks to the folks that adapted Walking Dead to AMC and made it such a hit. It's also one of those that has pushed boundaries with its use of graphic violence.
Yeah.
That's something that I know I didn't expect. Like I was wondering how they were going to, you know, pull that off, because I had read the comic before the show ever came out, and I was like, man, comics in black and white, you don't really see a lot of the you know, the true blood and gore that comes through whenever it's all in color. And I was thinking, man, it's AMC. I don't know that they can do this, but I'll be damned, they sure did. They didn't shy away from having these things pulling people's guts out and showing it in all its bloody entrail glory. But it is still a really emotional show because it's one of those that's, despite the zombie apocalypse happening around them, the theme of the show is that people are more dangerous than the zombies. And
I mean, it is.
You get really invested in these characters, too. That's the other powerful thing about the show, is that it's well acted. It's not always phenomenally written, but the acting is almost always on point. The characters are endearing. Like, you really get in, like, seriously emotionally invested in these characters. Except for Coral, who kind of becomes an insufferable little ass sometimes.
And just should have kept his ass in the fucking house.
Nah, he should have just stayed on that roof eating pudding.
Well,
I think that's
worst parenting ever.
That might have been the worst. That might have been the worst episode ever. Carl sits on a roof and eats pudding. There it is. But
there's a spinoff show right there. I can smell it.
It was called Fear the Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Which, I'm sorry, folks, but that show sucks.
No, we could spend an entire episode on just the things that Walking Dead has done wrong.
But it has done a litany of things right. It has
it has done a ton of things right that has led to other shows and even its own, you know, continuation, which we look at the seasons to show, hey, it's still popular.
Yeah, it's still popular and it still finds ways to feel fresh. And I think but it still owes that to the comics, though, because it pulls directly from the comic books. Even though it goes its own way a lot of times, they're bringing Negan in this season, and he's like one of the most popular characters in the entire book.
And the actor who plays him is, I can't think of his name, but he played the comedian.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Yeah, he's somebody I really like. He whatever he does, he usually does very well, you know. Yeah.
And I haven't read the comic up to the point where Negan is in it, but I am familiar enough with the character to have seen like what kind of portrayal I would expect from someone for that character. And when they cast Jeffrey Dean Morgan, I was like, well, you just nailed it. That's about as good as it gets right there. And when I saw his costume, I was like, man, it's like they ripped him right off the comic book page. It is uncanny. I gotta say, even though I'm skeptical, after everything I heard about this last season, because I'm running a season behind watching it through Netflix.
Yeah, I'm about the same.
I'm skeptical about how much I'm going to enjoy that season whenever it finally hits Netflix, but I'm actually legit excited for the season where Negan is a primary character. I'm actually kind of pumped to watch that. So, folks, I'm kind of getting back on board. I'm starting to feel excited about Walking Dead again, and I can finally say to those people who said it would come back around, congratulations, you were right. But it's time to move on to our final pick, our last pick in the top five. And I think if you guys know us, if you know me and Kelly, you probably saw this one coming. It's Arrow.
Yep.
It's Arrow. It's Arrow. And for
Mr. Ollie.
Mr. Oliver, Mr. Queen, if you will.
Only to his friends.
Only to his friends, of which he has few remaining after that season four. And we're gonna shit on Arrow a little bit later, but first we're gonna talk about what
sorry.
Oh, you're a jerk. I'm an Olicity shipper, so
Felicity is insufferable. She's just, I loved her.
Felicity was not written well in season four.
In season four, they got somebody that wrote fan fiction for Twilight and decided to write Felicity. And
yes,
goddamn them, they made me hate her. And I would love to see her get pushed out the bug. You know, just, oops, sorry.
No, I want more Felicity, but I want her back to how she was in season two.
Yeah, yeah.
And season three.
Even season one. I mean,
yes. Right. That's where we fell in love with her. That's where Felicity became a thing. But before we get off on the full Felicity tangent, we got to talk about what Arrow has done.
Mm-hmm.
It was that show that, I mean, the hype for the show coming into it, I felt like was kind of minimal because it was a show that, it was the first superhero show for CW since Smallville ended.
Yeah.
And, you know, there had been a version of Green Arrow on Smallville played by Justin Hartley.
And he did a good job.
He did a fantastic job playing the character. And when the trailers for Arrow were coming out, it had a decidedly different tone. It was more, it was darker, it was grittier.
There were killings.
Yeah, they were like, he was putting like bolts through people. It felt very Mike Grell, Longbow Hunters type of Green Arrow. And yeah, it was kind of irritating that they wouldn't call it Star City. They called it Starling City, and that they called him, they just called him Arrow rather than calling it Green Arrow. But, you know, nitpick things, really. But when the show started, I'll be honest, the first few episodes didn't really hit for me. Like, it was okay, but but there was some stuff in there that I was like, this isn't, I'm not sure this is going to work. But by about episode six, all the things that I said about the show that weren't working had just about all been dropped, and more of the stuff that was working was pushed out front. They were building a strong narrative with the characters, and I felt like everybody on the show was starting to like really embody the characters that they were portraying. Like, they were pulling stuff from the comic books, but still doing their own thing. They introduced, you know, a Dark Archer who was Merlin. Started playing up that idea, and of course teasing Deathstroke for what would become the phenomenal second season of that show. And one of
the island episodes.
Oh my God! Yes,
that's really where you started going. Because I really loved Slade. I was like, you know, Slade and Ollie were really becoming compatriots.
Yeah, it's like you see their this amazing relationship built between the two that you know is going to end with them being the just bitterest of enemies. And Manal Bennett played Deathstroke perfectly. Like, he was cold, calculating, but he was also... in the flashback sequences, he felt like a real person. He felt like somebody that you would sympathize with and really get attached to. And I know I did. I was really attached to that version of the character. But at the same time, you look at what Arrow was doing for the character, for its main character, for Green Arrow. Mm-hmm. It made people interested in his comic again. And DC recognized this. They were like, people are interested in Green Arrow. So we got to do something here to make our comics good again. And that was when Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino got on the main Green Arrow title. They came on to issue 17. It was one of DC's worst-selling books. And within just a couple of months, these guys had righted the ship, and suddenly Green Arrow's sales numbers were going up significantly.
Well, it's like Jeff Lemire's, when they brought him on, it was like, this is the way Arrow, the New 52, should have launched. Mm-hmm. You know, this was like, you know, the original Arrow or Green Arrow 52 just didn't ever find its footing until Jeff Lemire stepped up. And it was like, almost like, oh, here's issue one of Green Arrow. Sorry about the rest, you know.
It says 17, but it might as well say number one. And I loved how Lemire steps in and immediately kills off the terrible supporting cast that the book had up to that point and introduces a new one. He was like, yeah, you don't need this anymore. And then he pulled characters from the TV show, like Diggle made his comic book debut during that time. Yeah. So this is kind of a case, this is kind of the opposite case of comics influencing the show. This was the show influencing the comic books, but in a positive way.
Yeah.
Because it turned Green Arrow around, and now Green Arrow is looked at as one of the most popular properties that DC has again. And it hadn't been that way for a long time, not since the, probably the Mike Grell era in the 80s, which probably also wasn't quite as popular as the Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill Hard Traveling Heroes era of Green Arrow and Green Lantern. But I digress. But Arrow did something else, too. It has spawned its own little universe. And because you remember during season two, it introduced Barry Allen.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any he would go on to become the Flash, but he didn't have any powers at that time. But it was a little backdoor pilot for that character because they wanted to bring him to television, which is something that had been tried before. It was a show, I think it was in 1990, that starred John Wesley Shipp as Barry Allen. It only ran for a season and featured Mark Hamill as the Trickster. But that show failed to really take off, but this new version of Flash absolutely hit the ground running, not to put too fine a point on it. And after two highly rated seasons, we're headed into season three for it, which is just outstanding. And then Flash has created its own spinoff with Legends of Tomorrow, and now we're getting Supergirl. So yeah, but all of this is thanks to one show, Arrow. Arrow kicked this whole thing off, and if it weren't for the intelligent direction that that show has been taken in, none of these other shows would be happening. And it's not just about the story that this show is telling, but these characters have a lot of like people just deeply emotionally invested in them, because we all know that there's, I know you're limiting your maligning it a little bit, but all of us over here who love us some Felicity and Oliver together, like that's something that has become like a cultural phenomenon, and it's the impact of that is really what makes not just that, but of this show's impact across the CW, because now the CW is starting to become like a little superhero network.
And it almost seems like they're kind of irritated at the fact is like we're not making any other shows.
Yes, you are.
And it's like, you know what? If there's money involved and people want it, you're going to do it.
You
took on Supergirl, and knew that was already, you know.
They're totally coming around on it, though. I think they just say that because they don't want to get people's hopes up. But at the same time, I feel like if there's room to play and they've got it in this, they've got room in the schedule, you know what? They'll do it. Because, I mean, you look at the ratings for all of these shows, for Arrow, Flash, Legends, all of it's been good. Really good for them. And it's made more people pay attention to their network. So it's one of those things that's like, this is a now, like, cultural phenomenon. Superheroes are on TV. And Arrow, unlike the other superhero shows that we've mentioned up to now, it uses actual supervillains from the comics.
And they do it well. I mean, it's
incredibly for the most part. There have been a couple times where I was like, "Huh," what was that noise you make?
Hmm.
Yeah, that was my thoughts on a couple of villains that they brought into this show.
Most part they do them right.
Well, the little girl from Walking Dead, after her character got killed off there, she comes on to Flash and Arrow to play a C-lister. Or probably not a C-lister, probably like a D-lister comic book villain who's, it's not Queen Bee, I forget what her character name was.
I know what you're talking about.
You know the episode I'm talking about, but you talk about a hammed up, over-the-top, cheesy-ass performance. I mean, we're talking Batman and Robin level bad. Lots of stupid-ass B-puns in there. It's insufferable. It's insufferable. It's one of those where it's like, man, I'm really not going to feel bad for her when she gets punched in the face.
Yeah.
It's going to make this stop. And when she was gone, I was like, please don't bring her back again. And then they brought her back again. But I digress. The whole thing with Arrow, Flash, Legends, it all comes back to that one show, to Arrow just getting it right. And I think that one of the things that we talk about a lot is they just need to pay attention to what's being done in the comics.
Yep.
You know, they just need to pay attention to how, not so much the stories, but they need to pay attention to who these characters are. And that's why Arrow succeeds, because it is pulling those characters out of the comic books and putting them on the page, or putting them to the screen, and saying, all right, well, this is going to be a new take on them, but it's not going to forget who these characters are and what made them popular in the first place. And to kind of bring this part of the of the top five, to bring our top five to a close, that's kind of what we can say about every one of these shows. You can say that even though they go in their own direction, they tell their stories their way, you know, not really adapting stuff directly from comics in any one of these cases, but they've taken the characters from the comics and they've not forgotten, not neglected who each of them are at their core. Because these characters are enduring and endearing for a reason. And it's right there on the comic book page, and the makers of Adventures of Superman, Incredible Hulk, Wonder Woman, Walking Dead, and Arrow all understood that. And they have adapted those characters beautifully. And that, in a nutshell, is exactly why these are the definitive top five live-action comic book TV shows ever. But now, with that said, we had a couple of extra shows on each of our lists that we lobbied for and eventually got vetoed out. So, with that, Kelly, hit them with your two honorable mentions. What almost made the cut but got eliminated in favor of these?
My first was Daredevil. I love the Netflix show. To me, it's like the same kind of, it's like they just took it right from the source material. I mean, the casting is spot on. The stories are, very interesting. They're crafted well. The fight choreography is on, I mean, just spot on. And, you know, yeah, it's been two seasons, but, you know, it was one of those shows. It was like I wanted it to be on the list, but I understood why it didn't make it. But it's still a really good show. I'm not a big Daredevil fan. It's not that I didn't like the character. It just wasn't my character to kind of dig. But after, you know, I'm definitely watching the show. I'm definitely, you know, going to tune in every season they give it. Just because it's very much like the formula that DC has done with, like, Arrow and The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow and Supergirl. They really have kind of – they've pulled the best parts of the source material into the TV series and have continued to use it that way and are smart with it. So, yeah, that's my first.
Yeah, I would agree with every bit of that. What's your other one?
The other one is Smallville. I mean, Smallville, I think, in a lot of ways, kind of set the stage for why we have Arrow, why we have Flash. It showed that you can do a show like that and not have to. I mean, they started the people that wrote the show, I think, were fans. They had a lot. They threw in a lot of Easter eggs. There was a lot of just really cool. I remember the first episode, watching it back in 2000 with my buddy Chris. We're sitting there in my living room, and it comes on, and you see a truck driving down the highway. And you hear the Dukes of Hazzard thing being played on the radio. And, of course, you know, Schneider's playing...
John Schneider played Jonathan Kent.
Jonathan Kent, but also played Dukes of Hazzard. And I just started laughing. I was like, okay, I get it. I see this. I'm here. I'm it. I'm going to be a part of this show. And, you know, Annette O'Toole as Martha Kent. I mean, the casting was just phenomenal. And I never heard of Tom Welling. So seeing him Michael Rosenbaum, never have. But I saw the two together and I was like, that guy's Lex. That guy's Clark. The show itself was just so well crafted. And they started using a lot of stuff from the comics. Later seasons, you start seeing some kind of comic book villain tropes being thrown in. My favorite all time, this goes above every comic book television adaptation, I don't care what it is, this will always be my top number one episode. Is in season 8, the Legion of Superheroes show up. You see the original three, you know, Lightning Lad, Saturn Girl, Cosmic Boy. I literally almost wanted to tear up when I saw that episode. I was like, oh my God. My buddy Chris at the time was just giving me so much crap over it. I was like, he's like, you're such a fanboy. I was like, this is what fanboy's all about. Look at this. and Geoff Johns did it so well. I mean, it was like, it wasn't just like, oh, we're just going to throw these guys out there. And, you know, it's like they really did. For 45 minutes, you got to see, for me at least, my folks were on the screen, and I'm like, oh my God, this is, you know. And they brought in Supergirl too in season 7, and it was even more so. It's just like just a great show. But it was hard. I mean, 10 seasons. No other show has done that. Yeah, you know, no other show has hit that 10 season mark.
No, certainly no comic book show, although a couple of them are on their way. Walking Dead could, I think it's going to get there. But yeah, Smallville is another one of those that I personally love too. I mean, it had its down seasons too, and it never, I think the reason we left it off the list was because it didn't spawn any spinoffs. Like it was just its own thing. Even though it felt like it was teasing spinoffs, it never pulled the trigger on them. And it was just, but it was still a great show. It was still one that, it was one of those that just barely missed landing in the top 5. Mm-hmm. But I'm right there with you. Like I love that show, and it still has my favorite version of Jonathan and Martha Kent ever.
Yes, mine too.
And my definitive version of Lex Luthor. Yep. In my mind, Michael Rosenbaum is the definitive live action Lex Luthor, and if we were including Clancy Brown in that, he would win it out. But that's just me. Yeah. Now my two just barely missed the mark honorable mentions. One has to go to a little known action drama that ran on Fox for 2 seasons called Human Target. It starred Mark Valley, Shy McBride, and the immortal one himself, Jackie Earle Haley. Now, of course, I knew Jackie Earle Haley from Watchmen, where he played Rorschach. And when I saw that he was on this show, I was like, "Huh, I'm interested in this. It's an action show. It has kind of that '80s feel. It's like somewhere between A-Team and Mission Impossible." It had a lot of those things going for it. And it was based on a comic book character. It was created by Len Wein and Carmine Infantino for DC Comics. He actually first appeared in Detective Comics. I believe it was Detective Comics 201. But character of Christopher Chance is an ex-government operative who works as a private contractor, bodyguard, and a security expert. And he runs a protection business. He's hired to protect clients who have been like possibly targeted for assassination. And the usual deal is he takes on the target's identity for himself. So when the bad guys come for their target, they don't find their target, they find him. And he proceeds to go through some of the most kick-ass action sequences that have ever been filmed. And I will say this for this show. I know how awesome Daredevil's action sequences are. Human Target was better. I'm not even kidding. Human Target's action sequences, its hand-to-hand combat, unparalleled on live-action television. Now, I hate that the show didn't find a strong enough audience to stick around for more than 2 seasons, because it was charming with its lead characters. Mark Valley and Shy McBride especially had great chemistry. Jackie Earle Haley just stole every scene he was in. And like I said, amazing action. Just one of the most entertaining shows I've ever watched. I hate that it didn't make it longer than two seasons. So that's another reason that it didn't make the cut for the list, because it didn't elevate the character, didn't do anything for the comics, and well, that's just unfortunate. But that sort of thing happens. Now, my other honorable mention, my last honorable mention, of course, goes to one that everybody would have seen coming, The Flash, the current Flash TV show. I think we've all verbally filleted this show at some point or another. I know I have, and I'm going to continue to verbally fillet Grant Gustin as a true revelation of how to play a superhero character on television. His take on Barry Allen is second to none. I've never seen anybody play the character this well. I don't know that it will ever be. I mean, I'm going to give Ezra Miller all the chance in the world, because I like what I've seen of this kid so far. He was the best part of Suicide Squad for all 5-6 seconds that he was in it. And
I agree.
I thought he was charming and funny in the little Justice League snippet that we got. So, but going back to the Flash TV show, that show has done something I never thought possible. It made me give a damn about Vibe. I never thought that would happen.
Yeah.
Cisco Ramon, a character who is, and rightfully so, maligned in most comic book circles, and now he's one of the most endearing characters on television. That's brilliant.
That's casting, too. I mean, the actor they have playing him is... He's like... He's kind of the heart and soul of Flash.
He really is. But not to take anything away from Gustin, because he is the charming lead on television. But that kid playing Cisco Ramon... Wow. Just hats off to you. But the actor playing Joe West as well is another one that just... You talk about a guy who really delivers on all his scenes. He and Grant Gustin have just amazing chemistry together. That's something that... You know, I kind of wondered how that was going to go. Like, I knew Grant Gustin was going to be good, but how good was his supporting cast going to be? And nearly every one of them has just nailed it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what's really got me, like, invested, is I want to see more of these characters. And not just Barry. Like, I want to see everybody. It's just that's one of those things that you can say this is the mark of a really great show, is that it has not just a great lead character I want to see more of, but its supporting cast is amazing. And it's a nice touch that they brought in John Wesley Shipp, who played Flash in the 90s,
to play
Barry Allen's dad on the show.
The other actress who plays the head of Mercury Labs played his co-star in the Flash TV series for John Wesley. He played his Cisco. I mean, she played the scientist who's kind of helping him understand his powers.
Huh.
I can't think of her name, but I mean...
You have told me something I did not know.
Yep, so she was also...
And one thing I forgot to shout out during our talk about Arrow is that Stephen Amell is a great lead actor, but he's surrounded by an incredible supporting cast, not just Felicity, but Paul Blackthorne, who his character name slips my mind right now, but I remember the actor because he sticks out to me all the time.
Detective Lance.
Yes, like our Captain Lance now. I can't believe that just slipped my mind there for a moment. It must be late at night, and we're struggling to keep it going. But But yeah, he and Jesse L. Martin, who plays Joe West on The Flash, they're different characters, but I feel like they kind of serve that same purpose, and they are both equally great and just incredibly talented. And I consider it a crime that the Emmy nominating committee passes them over every single year, because if anybody from these two shows should be nominated, it should be those two guys. They are just phenomenal actors who deserve all the praise in the world. But that's it, folks. That brings us to the end of our definitive top five live-action comic book TV shows ever. And we gave you a few bonus picks, if you will, in there, for good measure, just because we wanted you to have an idea of what it was we were dealing with. So, like we said, you can find the complete list of shows that we use for nominations posted in the description of this episode. You know, tweet at me. Let me know what you think. You can find me on Twitter at Russell_Sellers, or you can find me through placetobenation.com. You can email me at rsellers@placetobenation.com. I would love to hear your thoughts. Pretty soon we're going to get Kelly set up on an email and on Twitter too, because I'm going to drag his ass kicking and screaming back into social media whether he likes it or not.
Okay.
That's not the noise you make. What's the noise? That will be Kelly's response to pretty much all of my suggestions from here on in. And I approve. But folks, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Sellers Points as much as we've had as much fun as we've had talking it, talking about all these shows again. Next time we're gonna do the inverse of this. So if you'll come back in a couple weeks, we're gonna hit you with the bottom five. That's right. We are going to tell you the bottom five live-action comic book TV shows ever. The worst. The oh my god shows. The ones that, there'll be a lot of that. That might just be the response to every one of these shows. It'll be a quick one. We won't spend a lot of time talking about them. I'll just be like, Kelly, what do you think about this show?
Next.
that will be his response. Spoiler alert, hashtag Gotham sucks. And we don't know. We haven't actually made that full list yet. We don't know if that's going to make the all-time worst. You'll just have to come back and see. You never know what we're going to put on this show. And with that, folks, thank you again for joining us here on Sellers Points on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. Don't forget to subscribe on Podbean, iTunes. Go and check us out on placetobenation.com. Find all the other great comic book TV, comic book shows that we've got out there, plus the other just great podcasts that you'll find on Place to Be Nation. There's a lot of stuff out there, whether you be a sports fan, you love comics, you love movies, music, and of course, there is just a wealth of content for you if you are a pro wrestling fan. So make sure you get out there and subscribe to both feeds through Podbean and through iTunes, because, well, this is the place to be. So with that, I'm Russell Sellers. For my cohort, Kelly Poole, we will see you guys next time.
See ya.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want, and baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe, tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel when everything is you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're near, I feel a change, something moves. I scream your name, look what you got to do.
your love, baby. Oh, no, baby. Girl, if I could only make you see and make you understand. Girl, your love for me is all I need and more than I can stand. Oh, well, babe, how can I explain all the things I feel? You've given me so much. Girl, you're so unreal still. I keep loving you more and more each time. Girl, what am I gonna do? Cause you're blowing my mind. I get the same old feeling every time you're here. I feel a change, something moves. I scream your name. Look what you got to do, and darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe. Oh no, babe.
Baby, it didn't take all of my life to find you. But you can believe it's gonna take the rest of my life to keep you.